total of 6 cases today. 3 of them are being submitted without oral argument, just on the briefs. They are appeal number 05-3187, Taylor versus Veterans Administration, Department of Veterans Administration, appeal number 05-3372, Matthews versus the Office of Personnel Management, and appeal number 05-7197, Lopez versus Department of Veterans Affairs. Of the 3 cases on the oral argument calendar, the first is appeal number 05-1250, Hovenek versus United States Postal Service. Mr. Kopko, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Yes. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ed Kopko. I'm an attorney representing Mr. Hovenek in this appeal. The facts of this case warrant the court extending the decision of the Ambro case, which was authored by Your Honor, Chief Judge Michelle, in 2002. The facts of this case, Your Honor, present much more than sloppy contract administration, as was noted by the board. What we have here...
Counsel, was there any provision of the lease? We apparently only have one page of it in the appendix, but was there any provision of the lease by which Mr. Hovenek, and thank you for the correction on pronunciation of his name, had a right to be notified about any concern of excessive rental rates in the year or two period leading up to the expiration of the original 10-year lease term?
No, sir, not in the contract per se, but in the Postal Service guidelines, there are specific provisions that pertain to that.
Say what with respect to the lessor being consulted year or two before the end of the period?
There are actually several provisions that pertain to the question that the court is posing to me. There is a provision under the Postal Service guidelines for the Postal Service to do a market survey.
Well, I understand that, but I'm trying to differentiate between what various employees of the service are supposed to do on the one hand, which I don't consider of much interest, and what Mr. Hovenek had a right to expect in the circumstance where the Postal Service, a year or two prior to the end of the period, developed a concern about possibly excessive rent. Does he have a right to be warned?
My argument is that, yes, he does have the right to be warned. Now,
I understand what your argument is, but what I'm trying to figure out is what language in what part of the manual, in effect, gives him a right to be warned that they have a rental rate concern in the period where they're deciding whether to renew the lease versus make alternate arrangements.
Although I can't invite Your Honor's attention to the specific provision, there is a provision that I rely upon that requires the Postal Service to monitor all contracts that contain an option purchase provision.
Granted. They should monitor it for Postal Service purposes. But where is there anything that says he has a right to be told that they have a concern that the rent is too high and that concern is going to impel them to make alternative arrangements?
There is no specific provision.
Isn't that a problem for your case?
No, sir, it's not a problem, because when you apply the doctrine of good faith and fair dealing and also the doctrine of bad faith to this case, I say that the Postal Service has an obligation in the performance of good faith and fair dealing to follow its own regulations. And in that regard, Your Honor, there are many provisions that a reasonable reading of that one could infer that Mr. Hovenek is entitled to be contacted by these things. I just invited...
Well, that's what I'm struggling with. If there's some text, even if it isn't a binding rule, that articulates a right to be warned, I'm calling it, about a rental rate concern, then maybe there's a foundation for your argument. But in the absence of some specific text, non-binding or binding, why isn't Mr. Hovannik in the place of any other lessor where the lessee has the right to renew or not renew as of the expiration date for any reason, good or bad?
Let me be so bold to suggest to Your Honor that it's the way the court is phrasing the question that is troublesome. It's not that he has a right to be warned about this. It's not, because there is no right to be warned about that. But if the court would entertain my position on this, that rather than looking at it as a right to be warned, why can't Mr. Hovannik expect that governmental officials are going to follow their own guidelines? When you look to those guidelines, there is nothing about this right to be warned business. But what there is...
What you have, Mr. Kupko, is an express contract that very clearly says this is a 10-year lease.
Yes, sir. No question about that.
And that any right to extension is at the discretion of Postal Service.
Not unfettered discretion, Judge Mayer. Not unfettered discretion whatsoever. Because the...
I see. I've got the wrong... Judge Lurie, but continue.
Oh, I beg your pardon. What I'm reading is...
You're reading accurately.
I beg your pardon, Judge Lurie, not knowing Your Honor personally.
That's right. I'm happy to be confused with the former chief.
Back to the point that I was addressing, Your Honor. There is no... this is a 10-year express contract. There's no doubt about that stuff. But what we have here and what I'm urging the court to consider is, in addition to that, when you have a contract with the purchase option, that the post office own guideline imposes certain responsibilities upon the post office. One of it is to monitor the lease. Number two, it's that they had an obligation to contact Mr. Hovannik to see whether he would be willing to sell it. None of those things happened here. What you have instead is a multi-year pattern of evasion and subversion of their own guidelines. And if they had followed those, Mr. Hovannik would have gotten the benefits of the contract that he believed that he was getting in the very early term of this stuff. Now, it's a 10-year contract, there's no question about that. But if they had followed the guidelines, Mr. Hovannik would have been willing to negotiate with them. Mr. Hovannik would have been willing to sell his property to him.
Why isn't it, counsel, harmless error that the guidelines weren't followed, even assuming they required what you say they required? Mr. Hovannik knew when the lease was expiring at the end of the 10 years. He presumably knew that real estate values in the town in question had fallen. Mm-hmm. He knew for sure that the lease has an even higher annual rental rate for the first option period than for the initial 10 years. And therefore, why couldn't he, knowing those things, have been on notice inside of his own brain that he better initiate some negotiation or he's likely to face a non-renewal?
He did that, Your Honor. The record clearly indicates that he contacted USPS. No one returned his telephone call. It's part of this pattern of subversion that I'm explaining to the court.
Well, he made one call, as I recall the affidavit, which was not returned, again, according to the affidavit. But as I understand the record, he did not initiate any correspondence or make any further calls or set up a meeting or go see anybody or take any other sort of affirmative step to protect his own chances of having the renewal period option exercise.
The answer to that, Your Honor, is that he was under the expectation from the prior conversations that he had that, in fact, it would be renewed. And if USPS had followed their own guidelines, it would have been renewed because the market survey was not done. If they had done the market survey, that would have triggered another obligation for them to contact Mr. Hovannik directly. One point I urge the court to consider here, no one from USPS ever directly spoke with Mr. Hovannik through any of this process.
I noticed that it's a little bit peculiar for a government official to call the spouse of a lessor and then act as if the conversation with the spouse somehow is the same as a conversation with the lessor. As I understand it, the property and the building built on it are owned by Mr. Ovanek as a sole proprietor, local contractor, which would lead me to suspect that Mrs. Ovanek has no ownership interest in this at all.
Sir, you're entirely right. She had no proprietary interest in this.
Therefore, no matter what she said, it would not bind her spouse as the actual landowner.
And more importantly, Your Honor, on all of the documents with USPS, it's only Mr. Ovanek. He is the lessor. Right? He not only owns the property, but he too is the lessor.
What you have is our assertions of bad conduct, administration, but do they overcome a clear contractual provision?
That's my point, Judge. When urging this court to extend the AMPRO decision here, my contention is that the board made all of the right findings of fact and all of the wrong conclusions of law. That, in fact, when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, when you look at this multi-year pattern of evading their own guidelines, when you look at what is really very egregious behavior, it is much more than sloppy contract administration. It rises to the level of a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and it implicates the AMPRO bad faith standard. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kopko. And just as a matter of curiosity, you live in Ithaca, New York.
Yes, sir. I live in Ithaca, New York.
Did you also attend college or university?
Oh, no, sir. I live in Ithaca because my wife tells me I live there. She teaches at Cornell University, and we had a long conversation about who was going to commute, and I lost.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Ms. Hogan. Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please the court.
Before you begin, would you reassure me that in this fact-intensive case, you've studied all the evidence, read all the depositions in their entirety, read all the affidavits in their entirety, know all the facts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you reassure me of that?
Yes.
Very well. Thank you. Please proceed.
The board's decision should be affirmed. Mr. Hovanek's rights are limited by the terms of the lease, which state that the lease may be renewed at the option of the Postal Service.
Can a contract never be overwritten by bad faith, or bad administration of the contract?
No, Your Honor. The bad faith argument that Mr. Hovanek is proposing requires that the Postal Service have a specific intent to injure him. And there's substantial evidence in the record that although there were mistakes made and sloppy administration, there was no intent to injure Mr. Ovanek or to prevent him or to harm him in any way.
Do you know who was at the initial discussions that led to the selection of the lease term of 10 years rather than his initial preference of 15 or 20?
The initial discussions, I believe, Your Honor, were between Mr. Hovanek, the postmaster, Ms. Maslin, and the real estate specialist. In terms of who signed the agreement to lease, I have to double check, but I believe that would be another postal employee.
The reason I'm concerned about that is whether the board had all the facts before it that would allow it to make a conclusion about intent to harm. For example, hypothetically, if Mr. Hovanek had been told by the contracting officer in the negotiations just before the lease was executed that if there was a rental problem, there would be negotiations initiated by the Postal Service, and then thereafter the Postal Service failed to initiate such negotiations, that might raise a question at least about whether that would support an inference of intent to harm him?
Well, Your Honor, the bad faith standard, the intent to harm, must be shown by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, I understand what the standard of proof is. My question to you is not what the standard of proof is or what actually happened. My question is whether the board had before it all the facts and evidence that would allow it to make a sound conclusion about the possibility that postal officials were, in fact, acting in bad faith, intending to harm Mr. Hovanec's monetary interests.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that suggests that anyone at any time told Mr. Hovanec that he had a right to be informed. Certainly, the postal regulations don't state that he has a right to be informed. It's the Postal Service's practice.
Well, I read his affidavit or the excerpts I have as suggesting, according to his recollection of the discussions, that the exercise of the option of the renewal period was practically guaranteed. Now, obviously, I don't know what actually happened. I wasn't there. I'm not a fact finder. But that seemed to be his version of the conversation. Now, if we don't have testimony from the postal official who was the other half of that conversation, how could we, or before us, the contract board, make a sound decision about the possibility of bad faith action? Intent to harm.
Well, the board makes its decisions based on the evidence that's presented by Mr. Hovanec and by the Postal Service. And to the extent that there's a lack of evidence, I think that shows that there was no evidence of that for the.
There was a Mr. Bland apparently involved in these early discussions. Was Mr. Bland presented by deposition or affidavit or otherwise?
So I don't believe he was, Your Honor.
So your best defense would be, well, that's Mr. Kopko's burden, not mine.
Yes, and then two, that there was a finding.
Or to put it differently, your predecessor in this case may have made a litigation gamble that Mr. Hovanec's testimony about that conversation would be disbelieved by the board, and that therefore the Postal Service didn't need to bring in its official, I think Bland, to say, no, I never said that. That's not, he doesn't remember it correctly. So the Postal Service can say that it was up to Mr. Kopko to bring in postal official Bland, but it looks to me like it really would have been a rebuttal witness to the affidavit of Hovanec, and therefore it would be the Postal Service's defensive witness, which they chose not to call.
Well, Your Honor, I can't address the reasons why Mr. Bland was not called. The board did find that that there was no specific intent to injure, and the conversations that Mr. Hovanec had with the postal officials in the terms of negotiating this lease.
Who owned the land on which the modular post office was placed across the street from Hovanec's building?
It was Ms. Maslin, the postmaster.
She's the postmaster of the town.
Yes, Your Honor.
And who owned the land on which Mr. Hovanec built the building?
It was also Ms. Maslin.
So he purchased her land to build the building he built, and then the Postal Service turned around and leased another plot of land owned by the same postmaster, so she benefited twice.
Yes, Your Honor, but again...
Doesn't that strike you as self-dealing that's a little bit questionable for one of the postal officials involved here to be the owner of two plots of land which are successively purchased, or respectively rather purchased and leased? Isn't that a little shady looking?
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is this is a small town and this was a fairly important person.
Well, that's no response at all to whether it's self-dealing. If Ms. Maslin's proper role in this drama is to be landowner, then she should be the landowner. She shouldn't be able to be the postal official making recommendations on the one hand, and then on the other hand be the landowner benefiting from the very same recommendations.
Well, Your Honor, the board specifically rejected the argument that the self-dealing was played a part in this action, and whether Mr. Hovanec was a victim, so to speak, of bad faith actions by the post office.
I read the board decision several times. I quite agree with you that that's what the board found. But the question we have to answer is, were those findings all supported by at least substantial evidence? What would the evidence be if we don't have Bland's version of the conversation? We don't have some innocent explanation of the apparent self-dealing by Ms. Maslin, the postmaster, then where is the substantial evidence that would justify the board to reject any notion of bad faith?
Well, the substantial evidence is that the repeated assertions by the Postal Service officials who were involved in this, that the reason that they did not renew the lease was economic, and that the decision to, I believe that the decision to use the second property was made only after they determined that the exercising the options on the Hovanec lease were not in the best interests of the Postal Service because of the market rent issue. So the decision not to exercise the lease was made purely as an economic reason.
What was the total cost of opening the town's third post office, the one across the street on Mr. Maslin's leased land?
I don't have that figure in front of me, Your Honor, but
well,
I do know that.
If you don't have the figure in front of you, does that mean the board didn't either?
No, it is in the record, Your Honor. I don't have it in front of me. I can be happy to put it into it.
We know what the cost of renting Hovanec's building for the next 5 years would have been. It's, I think, $17,000, if memory serves correctly. And we know the lease cost of Ms. Maslin's land across the street from Hovanec's building. That was something like $3,000. So there's a gap of about $14,000. But I couldn't find anywhere that we know the cost of the modular post office that I guess was plunked down on that plot of land. If that exceeded $14,000, then it's not clear to me that it was cheaper for the taxpayers, all of us in this room, to go the route of across the street rather than renewal, even at the presently stipulated rental rate of the Hovanec building.
On page 7 of the board's decision, the board makes a factual finding that the long-term cost of acquiring this third property and using it would be substantially cheaper than continuing.
They do indeed. But once again, what is the evidentiary basis of that? How can we satisfy ourselves that the evidentiary basis is substantial when so far no one has been able to identify what the evidentiary basis even is?
Well, Your Honor.
Ms. Hogan, was this question of self-dealing argued in the brief before us?
I do believe that that self-dealing is mentioned, although I don't believe that it's a cause of action, so to speak of.
That wasn't the heart of your opponent's argument.
No. No, the heart of...
It was sloppy administration.
Correct, and the allegation that this violated the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That duty of good faith and fair dealing imposes a duty not to interfere with another party's performance. But what Mr. Hovanec is trying to do here is to use that contractual element to expand its contractual obligations, or the Postal Service's contractual obligations beyond those that are in the express contract. The contract only says we will exercise the option at our discretion. Any regulations that the Postal Service was required to perform in its administration of managing real estate was for the benefit of the Postal Service and making sure that their rental properties were on market value. To the extent that Mr. Hovanec is an incidental beneficiary of that regulation, that's it. He did not have any contractual rights, and because that regulation is not here for his benefit.
When the handbook says some of its provisions are mandatory, what do you take that to mean?
I take that to mean that the Postal Service requires its employees to follow those directions, for example, documentation.
But you would say still only for the benefit of the Postal Service and not conferring any rights on private parties?
Correct, Your Honor.
So then you would take the position that nothing in the entire handbook can create any right in any private party?
Well, not having read the entire handbook, I'm not prepared to say that. I will say that with respect to the provisions that we're dealing with here, which are found on page 368 of the appendix.
That's a very good, careful answer. You're going to be a very good lawyer.
With respect to the provisions that deal with the exercise of renewal options, those did not create any contractual or other rights for Mr. Hovanec.
Am I correct that no grade brief was filed by opposing counsel in this case?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And was it a surprise to you this morning to hear Mr. Kopko's primary reliance being on a decision of this court that he didn't cite in the blue brief, but you sort of suggested to him by citing it on page 10 of your response brief?
Yes, Your Honor. I forgot for a moment which case that was, and I had to remember that it was my case.
AMPRO. What is your response to his suggestion that AMPRO ought to be extended to cover this situation, the facts of this case?
Well, Your Honor, AMPRO states that a showing of bad faith must be proved by clear evidence.
So you would say, I guess, well, he doesn't really want to extend it. He wants to totally change it and take out the bad faith element, or what?
I'm not sure what the reliance are. To the extent that he's relying on it for the standard of bad faith, it's clear to me that the bad faith is...
Of course, he is alleging bad faith, or arguing bad faith. All right, well, we thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Kopko and Rabeau.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, regarding this self-dealing business, one of the findings of the board was that Maslin, who was the local postmaster, knew in 1998 about the new search and that she concealed this from Mr. Hovanec.
Where did you argue that in your blue brief?
Pardon me, sir?
Where did you argue that in your blue brief?
I didn't argue that. I was responding to the court's question to opposing counsel regarding Maslin. In other words,
self-dealing is not really the argument you're raising.
I did mention that. I mentioned about Maslin in my brief, but I attempt to extend upon it now because Your Honor specifically asked about Maslin, and the board made a specific finding about that, and the finding was that she knew about it in 1998 and concealed it from Mr. Hovanec, notwithstanding the fact that he had asked her several times about it. I think that's an important point. The other point that Your Honor had raised is about Mr. Hovanec's conversations with Bland, and I respectfully invite the court's attention to the appendix at page 500, which internally is page 2 of Mr. Hovanec's affidavit. In paragraphs 8, 9, and 10, he specifically addresses his conversations with Mr. Bland and his reliance upon those conversations.
Am I correct that Bland was never heard from by the board?
Bland was deposed, but outside of the record, I did the deposition. He said he didn't remember the conversations with Hovanec. That's why it's not in the record.
Okay? Thank you.
In other words, there was no Bland argument made.
No, sir, there was no Bland argument made.
Okay. Now, Mr. Kopko, in your brief, you argue forcefully that the district chief in Albany directed, I think you even used that word, that the lease be renewed. And of course, in many parts of your argument, you relied on what the manual dictates. But as I read the manual, it dictates that the decision on renewal is not made by the district manager, in this case the person in Albany, but made by some real estate specialist in some sort of regional real estate office located in Connecticut.
Sir, the predicate act was in September of 1997. Albany sent a message to Mr. Wood.
I've read the message, you characterized the message as being a decision, a directive, an order to renew in the first option period. But as I read the handbook, it looks like such a document is not a decision. It's a request that an analysis be done by the real estate people, and then depending on pricing, et cetera, the real estate people either recommend to the CO renewal or they don't. But the decision is not up to the person in Albany. It's up to somebody in Windsor, Connecticut. Do you not agree with that?
No, sir, I don't, and I'll tell you why. I don't think it can be an either-or, something like either it's this notice or it's the Postal Service guidelines. I think that in any organization, you have to read it in its totalities. What the message in September 1997 said is, exercise the option. It didn't say exercise the option after you've done something else. It said exercise the option. And when Mr. Harold Wood gets that, the first thing under the guidelines that he's supposed to do is the market survey.
Right.
And he never does it.
Or at least it's not recorded. He says he did it, but
there's no record of it whatsoever.
Yeah. So then I guess you're arguing that the communication from the Albany chief may not be binding or controlling, but it's highly relevant. Is that a fair characterization?
I think if it's not controlling, it is highly relevant, and it's the initial step that starts this cascade of not errors, because errors suggest there may be some unintentional conduct there. I think that there are so many errors in this case that the only reasonable inference that you can make from all of them is that they just weren't going to do this under any circumstances. They weren't going to exercise this under any circumstances, and everything that they could possibly do to avoid it was done.
All right. I think we have your argument squarely in mind. We thank you. We thank both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.